She stifled a smile.
After about 2 hours, we reached Hilltop, a desolate spot out in the sagebrush at the canyon's rim, where the horse trail led down to the village. There was no sign of Fidel Hanna. We all got out of the hearse and stood there listening to the wind, my two customers clearly disgusted with the unreliability of the heathens that had come to help. All of a sudden, a band of young Indians on horseback, half-naked with painted faces, galloped up the trail and circled us, whooping and brandishing spears. Miss Pearl turned white, and Miss Finch gave a shriek and covered her head with her arms. But by then I'd recognized that the ringleader, under his war paint, was Fidel Hanna.
"Fidel Hanna, what the blazes do you think you're doing?" I hollered.
Fidel pulled up in front of us.
"Don't worry," he grinned. "No scalp 'em white ladies. Hair too short."
He and the other Havasu boys all started laughing, so beside themselves with glee at their success in terrorizing the do-gooders that they almost fell off their horses. Rosemary and I couldn't help chuckling, too, but my customers were outraged.
"You all belong in the reformatory," Miss Pearl declared.
"No harm done," I said. "They're just kids playing cowboys and Indians."
Fidel pointed at three of his friends, who jumped off their horses and doubled up with others.
"Those are your mounts," he said to us.
Then he held out his hand to Rosemary. "You can ride with me," he said. He pulled her up behind him, and before I could say anything, they were galloping down the trail. Miss Pearl, Miss Finch, and I followed at a walk on our horses. The trail to the village was 8 miles long, and it took most of the day to travel it. The path wound down the side of the canyon through a series of steep switchbacks, passing walls of limestone and sandstone layered like giant stacks of old papers. Several years earlier, some missionaries had tried to haul an upright piano down to the village so the Havasupai could sing hymns, but it had fallen off the cliff. We passed its smashed remains, black and white keys, twisted rusting wire, and splintered wood lying among the rocks. After a few hours, we came to a spot where clear, cold water gushed from an artesian spring, and that was where the stony landscape of the upper canyon gave way to lush greenery. Cottonwood, watercress, and willows lined the trail. The air was cool and moist and still. Rosemary, Fidel, and his friends were waiting for us by the stream, letting their horses graze, and we all continued on together. The stream, fed by additional springs, gathered in strength and size the farther we went. Eventually, we reached a spot where the stream descended in a series of short falls. Then we rode on for a ways before reaching the most breathtaking place I'd seen in my entire life. The creek poured through a gap in a cliff wall and cascaded 100 feet down to a turquoise pool. The air was filled with mist from the thundering fall. The water's vivid blue-green came from the line that leached out of the underground springs. The mist in the air had the same line in it and had covered everything near the falls, trees, bushes, rocks, with a white crystallized crust, creating one big natural sculpture garden. It was mid-afternoon by the time we reached the Havasupai village, a collection of wattle huts where the stream flowed into the Colorado River. Around the huts, the stream fed into several pools of the same turquoise water. Naked Havasupai children were splashing in the water. We all dismounted, and Fidel and his friends dove into the biggest pond.
"Mom, can I go swimming too?"
Rosemary asked, so desperate to get in the water that she was hopping from foot to foot.
"You don't have a swimsuit," I said.
"I could swim in my underwear."
"Certainly not," Miss Pearl piped up. "It was improper enough for you to be riding behind that Indian boy."
"And it would be unhygienic," added Miss Finch.
"There's no telling what you'd find in that water."
Fidel showed us to the guest hut. It was tight, but there was enough room for the four of us to stretch out on the mat on the dirt floor. Miss Pearl and Miss Finch were tired and wanted to rest, but Rosemary and I still had some gas left, and when Fidel offered to show us the valley, we took him up on it. He found us all fresh horses, and we set out on a tour. Walls of red Coconino sandstone and pink Kaibab limestone rose steeply on both sides of the river. The narrow strip of bottomland was green and fertile, and we rode past rows of widely planted maize. "Once upon a time," Fidel said,
The Havasupai had spent the winter hunting game on the plateau and come down to the valley to farm in the summer. But ever since they'd lost their traditional hunting ground to the Anglo settlers, they'd remained holed up down there year-round, in the most remote spot in the entire West. A secret hidden tribe living life the ancient way while most people on the outside world didn't even know it existed. Fidel pointed out a pair of red rock pillars towering above the cliff wall. Those were the Wagliva, he told us. They protected the tribe. It was said that any Havasupai who left for good would be turned to stone. This place is like heaven, Rosemary said. Even more than the ranch. I could live here forever. Only Havasupai live here, Fidel said. I'd become one, she said. You can't become a Havasupai, I said. You have to be born one. Well, Fidel said, the elders do say Anglos can't marry into the tribe. But as far as I know, none ever really tried. So maybe you could be the first. As evening came on, the Havasupai offered us fried cornmeal cakes wrapped in leaves. But Miss Finch and Miss Pearl would have none of them, so we ate the biscuits and jerky I had packed. The next day, Miss Finch gave medical exams to the Havasupai children, while Miss Pearl discussed their education with their parents, sometimes using Fidel as their interpreter. The village had a one-room school, but from time to time over the years, the state had decided that the Havasupai children weren't getting a proper upbringing and had swooped in to round them up and send them to boarding school, whether their parents wanted it or not. There they learned English and were trained for jobs as porters, janitors, and telephone operators. After a morning of interpreting for Miss Pearl, Fidel sat down next to me and Rosemary. You people think you're rescuing these children, he said, but they just end up unfit for both the valley and the outside world. Take it from me. I was sent to that school. Well, at least when you left, you didn't turn to stone, Rosemary said. What turns to stone is inside you. In the afternoon, Rosemary and I walked around the village. She continued to pester me about going swimming. I could tell that she could really see herself living here. Mom, it's the Garden of Eden, she kept saying. The Garden of Eden still exists on this planet. Don't idealize this way of life, I said. I was born in a dirt house, and you get tired of it pretty quickly. In the evening, after another meal of biscuits and jerky, we turned in early again, but I was wakened in the middle of the night by a commotion. Rosemary, streaming wet, was standing outside the hut, wrapped in a blanket. Miss Pearl had her by one arm and was shaking her, hollering about how she'd gotten up for some fresh air, and found Rosemary, Fidel, and a few other Indian kids swimming buck naked in the moonlit pool. I wasn't naked, Rosemary shouted. I was wearing underwear. As if that makes a difference, Miss Pearl said. Those boys could see you. What I was hearing made me practically blind with rage. I couldn't believe Rosemary would do this. I knew that Miss Pearl was appalled, not only at Rosemary, but at me as well, wondering what kind of mother would raise such a shameless child. Miss Pearl might well decide it made me unfit to be a teacher. But I was also plain furious with Rosemary. I'd slept next to that girl every night to protect her. I thought I had taught her to be smarter than this, taught her that young men were dangerous, that seemingly innocent situations could result in trouble, that one misstep could lead to a disaster she might never recover from. Plus, I'd told her she couldn't go swimming, and she outright disobeyed me. I grabbed Rosemary by the hair, pulled her into the hut, and threw her onto the floor, then whipped off my belt and started hiding her. Something dark came out of me, so dark it scared me. But even so, I kept at that girl, who was scrambling around on the dirt floor whimpering, until I had the sickening feeling that I'd gone too far. Then I threw down the belt and stalked past Miss Pearl and Miss Finch out into the night. The next day, it was a long ride back up to the canyon rim. Fidel Hanna had made himself scarce, but one of the other Havasu boys came along to bring back the horses. Miss Pearl kept going on about how she was going to report Fidel Hanna to the sheriff for committing indecencies with a minor. But Rosemary and I stayed quiet. Whenever I glanced at Rosemary, she had her eyes on the ground. Back at the ranch that night, I got into bed with Rosemary and tried to put my arm around her, but she pushed me away.
"I know you're mad at me, but you needed that whipping," I said.
"There was no other way to teach you a lesson. Do you think you learned it?" Rosemary was lying on her side, staring at the wall. For a minute, she was silent. Then she said, "All I learned is that when I have children, I'm never going to whip them." That trip to the Garden of Eden turned out badly for just about everyone. After I told Jim about it, we agreed that hiring Fidel Hanna again was out of the question. That was a moot point, because when Fidel heard that Miss Pearl was threatening to turn him into the sheriff, he joined the army. He became a crack sharpshooter and was sent off to fight in the Pacific Islands. But war eventually unhinged Fidel, and he was sent home suffering from shell shock. Not long after he returned, he came apart altogether and shot up a Hopi village. No one was killed, and when Fidel was freed from the state pen in Florence, he returned to the valley. But the Havasupai wouldn't allow him into the village because he'd brought shame on the tribe, and he became an outcast, living by himself in a lonely corner of the reservation. He had, in the end, turned to stone. After that business with Fidel Hanna, I decided the ranch was no place for my teenage daughter. If she'd go skinny dipping with Fidel, she'd go skinny dipping with any ranch hand who took her fancy. To instill a proper sense of caution concerning men, I gave Rosemary copies of True Confessions magazines with articles like, "We met in alleys and he led me down the path of sin." I also wrote to the Mother Superior at the Academy in Prescott, telling her that Rosemary had matured and was eager to try boarding school once more. Rosemary didn't want to go, but we packed her off again. No sooner had she left, it seemed, than we began receiving letters full of homesickness as well as reports of the D's and F's she was earning. All she wanted to do, the Mother Superior wrote, was draw pictures and ride horses. I was getting pretty exasperated with Rosemary, but also with those nuns, who I wished would learn to cut a 14-year-old daydreamer a little slack. But by then, we had something a lot bigger to worry about. The Palms wrote us a letter saying that, with the war on, they were going to sell the ranch to put their money in the munitions industry. If we could pull together a group of investors, they'd entertain our offer. But from that moment forward, the ranch was on the market. Jim and I had been squirreling away everything we could, and our savings were considerable, particularly because the Palms had given Jim a bonus during good years. But we didn't have nearly enough to buy Hackberry, much less the entire spread. Jim talked with the neighboring ranchers about forming various kinds of partnerships. He also met with a few bankers, and I called Buster in New Mexico. But the fact was, because of the war, hardly anyone had two extra nickels to rub together. People were rationing cloth, collecting tin cans, and growing victory gardens. Most people. Late on a January morning, a big black car pulled up in front of the ranch house, and three men got out. The first was wearing a dark suit, the second had on a safari jacket and leather gaiters, and the third wore big Stetson pressed jeans and snakeskin boots. Suit introduced himself as the Palms' lawyer. Gaiters turned out to be a movie director famous for his westerns who was interested in buying the ranch. Boots was some rodeo cowboy Gaiters had cast in a few bit parts. Gaiters, a beefy red-faced man with a groomed silver beard, was one of those people who acted as if everything that came out of his mouth, even the most obvious remark, was profoundly interesting. Each time he said something, he'd look over at Suit and Boots, who'd either chuckle appreciatively or nod sagely. It took Gaiters about 3 minutes to mention that he'd worked with John Wayne, or as he called him, Duke. He said things like, "Duke's the ultimate natural. Duke's first take is always his best take." When old Jake shuffled out from the barn, Gaiters was standing on the porch, surveying the land. He pointed to a willow next to the pond. "That's picturesque," he said. "Good place to plant a willow."
"Ain't got time around here to go planting no picturesque trees," old Jake said. "I reckon it just growed there."
He limped back to the barn, shaking his head. Jim and I showed them around, but since we weren't particularly keen on seeing the place sold out from under us, Jim was even more taciturn than usual. Gators, for his part, acted almost as if we didn't exist. He never asked questions. He and Boots kept tossing ideas at each other about how to improve the place. They were going to install a gasoline power generator and air condition the ranch house. They might even put in a pool. They were going to double the herd and breed Palominos. It was clear that Boots was this rhinestone cowboy who had dazzled Gators with horse jargon and rope tricks when, in fact, he didn't know diddly about ranching. In the middle of our tour, Gator stopped and looked at Jim as if he was seeing him for the first time. "So you're the manager?" he asked. "Yes, sir." "Funny, you don't look like a cowboy." Jim was wearing what he always wore, a long-sleeved shirt, dirty jeans with the cuffs turned up, and round-toed work boots. He looked at me and shrugged. Gator studied the weathered gray outbuildings with his hands on his hips. "And this doesn't look like a ranch," he said. "Well, that's what it is," Jim said. "But it doesn't feel like one," Gator said. "The magic is missing. We need to goose the magic." He turned to Boots. "You know what I see?" he asked. "I see everything in Knotty Pine." And Knotty Pine it was. After buying the place, Gators tore down the ranch house and built a fancy new place with exposed beams and walls of varnished Knotty Pine. Then he tore down the bunkhouse and built a new one in matching Knotty Pine. He renamed the spread the Showtime Ranch. True to his word, he put in the airstrip and doubled the size of the herd. Gators also fired Big Jim and Old Jake. They were too old and too old-fashioned. Old-timers, he called them. And he said he needed to find people who would help him goose the magic. Then he fired all the ranch hands, who were mostly Mexicans and Indians, because they said they didn't look like cowboys. He hired Boots to run the place and brought in a bunch of fellows from the rodeo circuit who wore tight new jeans and embroidered shirts with pearl snap buttons. We had lived on that ranch for 11 years, and we loved the place. We knew each and every one of those 180,000 acres. The gullies and washes and mudflats, the sagebrush plateau, the boulder-strewn mountains and juniper-covered foothills, like we knew our own hearts. We'd respected the land. We knew what it could and couldn't do, and we'd never pushed it beyond its limits. We'd never squandered the water, and we'd never overgrazed the grass, unlike our neighbors. Anyone riding the fence line would see grass 4 inches high on our side and 1 inch on theirs. We had been good stewards. The buildings may have been a little rough on the eyes, but they were in good repair, still solid and true. There wasn't a more honestly run ranch in all of Arizona. We'd known all along, of course, that we didn't own the place. But at the same time, we couldn't help considering it ours. And we felt dispossessed, like my dad and his pa did when the settlers started fencing in the Hondo Valley. "Guess I've been put out to pasture," Jim said after Gators delivered the news. "You know you're the best at what you do," I told him. "Just seems like what I do don't need to be done anymore." "We've never felt sorry for ourselves before," I said, "and we're not going to start now. Let's get packing." We had our savings, so we weren't in a bind financially. I decided we should move to Phoenix and make a fresh start. Arizona was changing. Money was pouring in. Because it had perfect weather for flying, the Air Force had discovered the state, building bases and landing strips all over the place. At the same time, lungers, folks with breathing problems, were arriving in droves. And what was more, air conditioning had become affordable, making places like Phoenix appealing to those eastern lace panties who couldn't tolerate its true temperatures. The city looked like it was going to take off. When I called Rosemary to tell her we were leaving the ranch, she became almost hysterical. "We can't, Mom," she said. "It's all I've ever known. It's inside me." "It's behind you now, honey," I said. Little Jim was beside himself as well and said he outright refused to go. It's not up to us, and it's not up to you either, I told him. We're gone. Since ranching was going to be in our past, I wanted to get rid of most everything that had to do with it. We sold all the horses to Gators except Patches, who was pushing 30. I gave her to the Havasupai. Rosemary might never see the Garden of Eden again, but at least she'd know that a horse she loved was there. I did keep the English riding pants and the pair of field boots I'd been wearing the day I'd fallen off Red Devil and met Jim. Everything we owned fit into the back of the hearse. And on a beautiful spring day when the lilac was blooming and the warblers were singing in the hop trees, we packed it all up and headed down the drive. Rosemary was still at boarding school. She'd never returned to the ranch. Little Jim, who was sitting between me and Jim, twisted around for one last glance. "No looking back," I said. "You can't. You just can't." Chapter 8. Gumshoes. Jim decided that we should start our new life in Phoenix by splurging. "Name something you've always wanted," he said. "New choppers," I said immediately. My teeth had been giving me trouble for years, but folks on the Colorado Plateau weren't big on dentists. If a tooth wouldn't stop aching, you found yourself a pair of pliers and pulled the bugger. I also had a gap between my two front teeth, where they had rotted in from the sides. I tried to keep the gap plugged with a piece of white candle wax, but when the wax fell out from time to time, I had to admit, it looked a little scary. Jim's teeth were every bit as bad. "You get yourself a pair too," I said. Jim grinned. "Two new sets of choppers. That should get us going just fine in this here town." We found a nice young dentist who shot us full of Novocaine, pulled out our worn-down brown teeth, and fitted new sets of dentures to our gums. The first time he put them in place and held up the mirror, I was thrilled by those two flawless rows of big, gleaming white porcelain, as shiny and square as kitchen tiles. Overnight, I'd gotten myself the smile of a movie star, while Jim looked about 30 years younger. The two of us walked around the city, beaming radiantly at our new neighbors. We also bought a house on North 3rd Street. It was a big old place with high windows, sturdy wooden doors, and adobe walls about 2 feet thick. Finally, we junked that beater of a hearse and bought a maroon Kaiser, a new kind of sedan made in California with wide bumpers and running boards. I was proud of that house and proud of that car, too. But nothing made me prouder than my new set of choppers. They beat the pants off real teeth, and from time to time when I was in a restaurant or someplace telling someone about them, I couldn't help it. I had to pull them out and show them off to prove that they were the genuine article. "Look," I'd say as I held them up, "they're not teeth. They're real dentures." At first, I thought Phoenix was terrific. Our house was near the center of town, and we could walk to stores and movie theaters. I made a point of going to every single restaurant on Van Buren Street. I especially loved cafeterias, because you could actually see the food before you ordered it, instead of flying blind with a menu. After all those years of sitting on orange crates and drinking from coffee cans, I went out and bought a carved mahogany dining set in Bavarian china. For the first time in our lives, we got a telephone, which meant people who wanted to get in touch with me didn't have to leave a message with the sheriff. Little Jim, however, hated Phoenix from the get-go. "You feel penned in," he said. "You feel puny." And when Rosemary's boarding school let out and she joined us in the city, she hated it too. They hated the black asphalt and the gray concrete. They thought air conditioning was weird and noisy, and the telephone just allowed busybodies to pester you day and night. Phoenix was square and straight, boxy and boxed in, and above all, fake. "You can't even see the ground," Rosemary complained. "It's all covered up with pavement and sidewalks." "But think of the advantages," I said. "We eat at cafeterias. We have indoor plumbing." "Who cares?" Rosemary said. "Back at the ranch, you could hunker down and take a pee whenever you had the urge." She added that living in Phoenix was even making her question her faith.
I've been praying daily to go back to the ranch, she said. Either God doesn't exist or he doesn't hear me.
Of course he exists and of course he hears you, I said. He has the right to say no, you know.
But I did begin to worry about the effect Phoenix was having on that girl. She had no use for indoor plumbing, questioned the existence of God, and even acted all embarrassed when, the next day at the luncheonette, I took out my dentures to show them off to the waitress. I didn't care to admit it to the kids, but after a few months, I started feeling a little pinned in myself. The traffic drove me crazy. Back in Yavapai County, you drove wherever you wanted, at whatever speed you wanted, and left the road whenever you were so inclined. Here there were stoplights, cops with whistles, yellow lines, white lines, and all manner of signs ordering you to do this and forbidding you from doing that. Cars were supposed to mean freedom, but all these people stuck in traffic on one-way streets, where you weren't even allowed to make a U-turn to get the hell out of the jam, might as well have been sitting in cages. I found myself constantly arguing with other drivers, sticking my head out of the window of the Kaiser, which was always overheating, and hollering at those dimwits that they should go back east where they belonged. Nothing had ever made me feel as free as flying, and I was only a few hours away from getting my pilot's license, so I decided to take up lessons again. The airport had a flying school, but when I showed up one day, the clerk passed me an entire sheaf of forms and started yammering about eye exams, physicals, takeoff slots, elevation restrictions, and no-fly zones. I realized that these city folks had boxed off and chopped up the sky the same way they had the ground. One thing about Phoenix, though, there were a lot more jobs available than in Yavapai County. Jim was hired as the manager for warehouse, stocking airplane parts, and I landed a teaching position in a high school in South Phoenix. There were also investment opportunities in the city. After paying for our house on 3rd Street, we still had money left over, and we used it to buy a few other small houses that we rented out. Distressed properties were always coming onto the market at bargain prices. Jim and I attended courthouse auctions and bid on foreclosures, and I started carrying around a $10,000 cashier's check in my purse, just in case I happened across anyone needing to sell quickly at a discounted price. For the first time in our lives, we were living on the backs of others, but that was how you got ahead in the city. When Jim said it made him feel like a vulture, I told him that scavengers got a bum rap. Vultures don't kill animals, they live off the dead, I said, and that's what we're doing. We're not bringing misfortune on these people, we're just taking advantage of it. I worried constantly that someone might snatch my purse and make off with the check, so I kept the bag clutched to my chest when I walked through town. That was only one of a number of things I found myself worrying about in Phoenix. We bought ourselves a radio that we could listen to all day long now that we were living in a house wired for electricity. At first, I thought that was just grand, but it meant for the first time I was also listening to the news every day, and about every day, it seemed, there was a report about some crime or another in town. People are always getting robbed or having their cars stolen or their houses burgled if they weren't getting raped, shot, or stabbed. A Phoenix woman named Winnie Ruth Judd, known as the blonde butcher and the trunk murderess because she'd killed two people and put their bodies in her luggage, kept escaping from the insane asylum she'd been sent to, and the news was always filled with accounts of possible trunk murderess sightings, along with warnings to the citizenry to lock all doors and windows. So I kept my pearl-handled revolver under my bed. I also bought a little .22 pistol to carry in my purse along with the check. Every night, I made a point of bolting the doors, which we had never done at the ranch, and I slept on the outside of the bed I still shared with Rosemary, keeping her next to the wall, so if anyone got through the locked doors and attacked us, I could fight them off while Rosemary escaped. "Mom, you've become such a worrywart," she said. Rosemary was right. On the ranch, we worried about the weather and the cattle and horses, but we never worried about ourselves. In Phoenix, people worried about themselves all the time. People also worried about bombs. Every Saturday at noon, the air raid siren was tested, and an ear-splitting whoop-whoop-whoop blared through the city. If the siren sounded at any other time, that meant an attack was underway and you were supposed to run to the bomb shelter. Rosemary couldn't abide the siren, and when it went off, she buried her head under a pillow. "I can't stand that noise," she said. "It's for your own good," I said. "Well, all it's doing is scaring me, and I don't see the good in that." The girl was developing a pronounced contrarian streak. One morning that August, when Rosemary and I were walking down Van Buren Street, we passed the storefront where a bunch of people were gathered, gawking at an automatic donut-making machine. Next to it was a newsstand, and it was when I glanced down at the headlines that I first learned about the atom bomb falling on Hiroshima. I bought the paper, and as I read, I tried to explain to Rosemary what had happened. Rosemary couldn't believe that a single bomb had obliterated an entire city. Hundreds of thousands of people, not only soldiers, but also grandparents, mothers, children, as well as dogs, cats, birds, chicken, mice, every living thing. "Those poor, poor creatures," she kept sobbing. I tried to argue that it was the Japs who started the war, and because of Hiroshima, thousands more American boys would not have to die fighting them. But Rosemary decided that there was something sick about the atom bomb. The death of all those mice and birds was just as upsetting to her as the deaths of the people. After all, she said, the animals hadn't started the war. She also decided there was something sick about Americans who would stand there gawking at a donut maker while there was so much agony on the other side of the world. "Focus on the positive," I said. "You live in a country where no one has to make donuts by hand." Rosemary's feelings got even darker that fall. We'd enrolled her at St. Mary's, a Catholic church a few blocks from the house, and the nuns, who kept reminding their students that all life was sacred, showed some Japanese newsreels of the devastation at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The scenes of flattened city blocks, incinerated corpses, and babies deformed by radiation gave Rosemary nightmares. The nuns told her that we needed to pray for the Japanese because they were God's children too, and they had lost their sons and daughters and fathers and mothers. I was less sympathetic. "That's what happens when you go around starting wars," I said. But Rosemary was distraught. No one but God, she thought, should be able to kill so many people so easily and so quickly as we had done with the atomic bomb. That her own government had that kind of power made her very afraid of it. Now that it had the bomb, who was it going to bomb next? What if it decided she was the enemy? When I got tired of explaining that the end justified the means, I told Rosemary to stop talking about Hiroshima, because if she stopped talking about it, she'd stop thinking about it. She did stop talking about it, but one day I looked under the bed we still shared and found a folder full of drawing after drawing of animals and children, all with Japanese eyes and angels' wings. Rosemary started drawing and painting more obsessively than ever. As far as I could tell, it was her one talent. Her grades were still terrible. I signed her up for violin and piano lessons, but her instructor said she lacked the discipline to practice. I tried to defend her, arguing that improvisation, not recitation, was her musical forte. But one day the instructor said if he had to listen to her torturing that poor violin one more minute, he'd puncture his own eardrums. "What are we going to do with you?" I asked her. "I'm not worried about me," she said. "And no one else should be either." A lot of pretty girls lost their looks when they reached adolescence, but Rosemary was still a stunner, though I'd kept my promise to myself never to tell her this. However, I was getting a little desperate, and one day when I read a newspaper article about a beauty contest, I figured maybe Rosemary should go ahead and play that card. "I have an idea," I said. "You can be a beauty queen or a model." "What are you talking about?" Rosemary said. I told her to put on a bathing suit and walk back and forth in front of me. It wasn't promising. She had the looks and the figure, but she moved like a cowgirl, not a beauty queen, swinging her arms vigorously with each big stride. So I enrolled her in modeling school, where she learned how to walk with a book on her head and get out of a car without showing her underpants. But at her first photo session,
when the photographer told her to flirt with a camera. She couldn't stop giggling self-consciously, and the man shook his head. What Rosemary really wanted to do was be an artist. "Artists never make money," I said, "and they usually go crazy." Rosemary pointed out that Charlie Russell and Frederick Remington had both gotten rich painting Western scenes. "Art's a great way to make money," Rosemary said. "For the cost of a piece of canvas and some paint," she went on, "you could create a picture worth thousands of dollars." "In what other line of work could you do that?" "A blank canvas," she kept arguing, "was a treasure waiting to happen." I finally took some of her drawings to a few frame shops and asked the clerks if they thought my daughter had any talent. They said she showed promise, so I arranged for her to take lessons with Ernestine, an art teacher who wore a beret just in case you couldn't tell from her accent that she was a frog. Ernestine taught Rosemary that white wasn't really white, that black wasn't really black, that every color had other colors in it, that every line was made up of more than one line, that you should love the weeds as much as the flowers because everything on the planet had its own beauty, and it was up to the artist to discover it. There was no such thing as reality, because the world was as you chose to see it. All this struck me as a lot of hogwash, but Rosemary really lapped it up. "You know what's the greatest thing about painting?" she said one day. "What?" "If there's something about the world you don't like, you can paint a painting that makes it the way you want it to be." With Ernestine's lessons, Rosemary's painting became less and less about the thing she was painting and more about what she was feeling at the moment. Around this time, she started spelling her name Rose Mary because she thought it made for a prettier signature. I continued to pay the frog for lessons, but I kept reminding Rosemary that art was an iffy proposition, that most women still had to choose between being a nurse, a secretary, and a teacher. And for my money, teaching beat the other hands down. The funny thing was, even while telling Rosemary this, I was not, for the first time in my life, enjoying my job. I was teaching math and English at a large high school. A lot of the kids came from highfalutin families, wore fancy clothes, a few actually drove their own cars, and refused to obey me if they didn't feel like it. It was also the first time I had not been on my own, teaching in a one-room school. I had the principals and other teachers second-guessing me, forms to fill out, and committees to sit on. Half my day was spent doing paperwork for the bureaucracy. There were more rules for teachers than for students, and those bureaucrats were awfully persnickety about you following those rules. Once when I opened my purse in the teacher's lounge, one of the other teachers saw my little pistol and just about had a fit. "That's a gun," she gasped. "Barely," I said. "It's only a .22. Still, she reported me to the principal, who warned me that if I ever brought a gun to school again, I'd be fired. "How am I going to protect myself and the students?" I asked. "That's what the police are for," he said. "Who's going to protect us from the police?" "Just leave the gun at home." Jim never complained, but I could tell his job chafed him as much as mine did me. He was bored, a big, broad-shouldered guy sitting awkwardly behind a little metal desk, checking his inventory list and watching the Mexican workers boxing up airplane parts. Jim wasn't a desk man. He also had a lot of downtime, which he wasn't used to, and he spent a fair amount of it shooting the breeze with a warehouse bookkeeper, a tarted-up divorcee I did not take to named Glenda. She called him Smithy and was always asking him to light her cigarettes. My husband just didn't see the point of city life, didn't understand why anyone would want to live like this. So many things about it struck him as contrary to the proper and natural way of the world. Shortly after we moved to the city, they cut down all the orange and cottonwood trees that shaded the streets to make room for more parking. "Seems to me you lose more than you gain," Jim said. The simple truth was, he missed the outdoors. He missed the sweat and dust and heat of ranching, the smells and hard labor. He missed the way that ranch life forced you to study the sky and the land every day, trying to anticipate nature's intentions. On Sundays, we took walks in Encanto Park in the middle of the city. And out of habit, Jim continued to be mindful of what the plants and animals were telling him. As fall came on that year, he noticed that the birds were migrating south earlier than usual. Squirrels were storing extra nuts, and their tails were unusually full. Acorns were especially large. The bark on the cottonwoods was thicker, and so were the hulls on the pecan nuts. "Gonna be a hard winter," he said. The signs were all there. He hoped other people were reading them too. And that winter was hard. It came on early, and in January it snowed in Phoenix for the first time in most folks' memory. Back on the ranch, a blizzard like that would have been a call to action, forcing us to run around collecting firewood, bringing in the horses, and carting hay to the range. Jim would build a windbreak to protect the cattle. He'd empty all the wagons out of the garage and make a wall of them between the house and the barn, covering it with tarps, coats, and blankets, then buttressing it with old trunks and anvils and dirts and rocks and whatever he could find. He'd round up as many cattle as could fit in the barn, and when the storm reached us, he was outside on horseback, keeping the cattle moving, keeping their blood circulating. Every couple of hours, he'd rotate a new group into the barn and behind the wall of the wagons so they could get a break from the wind and snow. Living in the city, all we did was turn up the radiator and listen to the hiss and clank of the pipes. The snow kept falling, and the next day the governor went on the radio, declaring a state of emergency. School was canceled and most businesses were closed. The National Guard was called out to rescue people stranded in remote parts of the state. Jim said he hoped Boots and Gaiters knew what they were doing. He hoped all the cattle had been moved off the plateau down to the winter range, and the hands had broken the ice on the ponds. "The first thing you got to do is break the ice," he said. "The cattle will die of thirst before they starve." On the third day of the storm, we got a knock on the door. It was a man from the Arizona Department of Agriculture. "Cattle were dying across the state," he said. "Ranchers needed help. And the name that kept coming up was Jim Smith." It had taken them a while to track him down, the man said, but he was needed. Jim threw some heavy clothes into his old army duffel bag, grabbed his hat, and was out the door in less than 5 minutes. The first thing Jim did was organize drops of hay. He had a big cargo plane filled with round bales, and they took off into the storm. When they reached the range, the crews rolled the bales out of the back of the cargo bay and watched as the hay tumbled through the snow and bounced on the ground. Since the roads were impassable, Jim asked the government for a small plane and a pilot, and they flew across the state, touching down at isolated ranch houses. Jim explained to the ranchers, most of whom had never seen blizzards the likes of this one, what to do. "You got to break the ice on the ponds," he told them, "and cut down the wire fence. Let the cattle roam. They need to move to keep their blood circulating, and they'll instinctively move south. But if they hit a wire fence, they'll all press up against it and die. Let them get into big herds and huddle for warmth. You can sort them all out by the brands later." At one ranch up in the hills, there was no place to land. Jim had never put on a parachute before, much less jumped, but he strapped one on. "Count 10, pull the cord, and roll into the fall," the pilot said, and Jim heaved himself out of the plane. The storm had stopped, but the temperatures were still frigid when Jim reached the Showtime Ranch. Even before he landed, he could see from the air that no one had broken the ice on Big Jim. Carcasses of frozen cattle lay clustered around the pond's edge. When he got to the ranch house, he found Boots and the new hands sitting around Gator's fancy propane stove, their feet up, drinking coffee. "Any mutton head can run a ranch during good times. You only find out who the real ranchers are when calamity strikes. Those dunces sitting around that stove may not have been able to read tree bark, but at the very least, they should have been listening to the weather reports. And when they heard that a devil of a storm was coming down from Canada, they would have had 24 hours to prepare. I would have lit into that fool Boots and those other chumps, but that was not Jim's way. He did, however, get their sorry butts out and mounted up to cut wire, break ice, and start the cattle moving. There were thousands of dead cattle lying rock hard in the snow, piled along the southern fences. Some of the cattle that had survived were so weak they couldn't walk, so Jim had the men bring them hand water and hand feed them. He massaged their legs, which were cut from where they'd tried to break the ice themselves, and helped them stand again. If he could get them moving, he knew, they'd live. Jim was gone 2 weeks. That whole time, I didn't know where he was or how he was doing, and it was the longest 2 weeks of my life. When he finally came back, he'd lost 20 pounds. His face and hands were raw. He hadn't slept for days, and there were dark circles under his eyes. But he was happy. He hadn't felt this useful since leaving the ranch. He'd been out doing what he was meant to do. He was Big Jim again. A few days after Jim returned, he got a call from Gators. When Jim had been back in Yavapai County during the blizzard, people had told him that Gators had been going around referring to him as a relic and washed-up old geezer. But that was before the storm. Now Gators was so impressed with the way Jim had salvaged what remained of the Showtime's herd that he offered Jim his old job as ranch manager. He'd even build us our own Knotty Pine caretaker's cabin. "You're the real thing," Gators said. Jim and I discussed it, but we agreed right away that it was not for us. Before, we had been the ones running the ranch, making all the decisions. The storm had humbled Gators somewhat, but he still had his cockamamie notions for goosing up the Showtime. Jim didn't want to do Gators' bidding or have to spend his time arguing the man out of foolish ideas. What was more, there was no possibility of us someday buying the place. I told Jim I didn't want to live in a caretaker's cabin, even a Knotty Pine one, waiting for the owner to fly in with his Hollywood friends for weekend parties and leading dudes on trail rides. I'd been a servant before, and once was enough. The following month, I had a school holiday and was in town running errands when I decided to swing by the warehouse. An article about the work Jim had done saving the herds from the blizzard had appeared in the newspaper, along with a photograph of him standing by the plane he jumped out of. The headline read, "Cowboy Parachutes Through Blizzard to Rescue Cattle." My husband had become a bit of a local hero. People recognized him on the street and stopped to shake his hand. One guy even hollered, "It's the parachuting cowboy!" Jim thought it was all a little ridiculous, but I couldn't help noticing the way women smiled and flirted with the parachuting cowboy when he doffed his hat or opened the door for them. Jim didn't expect me that day, and when I walked into the warehouse, Glenda, the floozy bookkeeper, was standing in his doorway talking to him. She had jet black hair and blood red lipstick, wore a tight purple dress, and was leaning with her back against the doorframe to show off her figure. She had on one of those wire bra contraptions, and it pushed her bosoms forward like a couple of airplane nose cones. When she saw me, instead of seeming contrite, she gave her bosoms a little jiggle and looked at my husband. "Uh-oh, Smithy," she said. "Are we in trouble?" My blood boiled up, and I was sorely tempted to backhand that hussy. But instead I looked at Jim to get his reaction. If he was all hot to trot, there was going to be hell to pay. But Jim just seemed embarrassed, more for the tart than for anything he'd done. "Knock it off, Glenda," he said. The two of us went out to a cafeteria for lunch, and I didn't say anything about Glenda's little display, but I made a mental note to keep an eye on the two of them. Truth be told, as the days went by, I couldn't help wondering if there was actually something going on between Jim and the floozy. At times, the two of them were all alone in that big warehouse, and there were plenty of hidden nooks and crannies to provide sights for hanky-panky. And then they both had lunch hour, again, giving them ample time to duck into some hot sheets hotel. In other words, they both had opportunity, and she clearly had motive. The question was, did my husband? There was no point in confronting Jim, because if he was turning out to be another crumb bum like my first husband, he'd simply lie. I thought I knew Jim, but I also knew you couldn't or shouldn't trust men. An otherwise sensible man might be driven wild if an irresistible temptation presented itself.
and there was a heck of a lot more temptation wagging its tail in Phoenix than there ever had been in Yavapai County. Also, men can change. Maybe this parachuting cowboy business had gone to Jim's head. All the adoring ladies with their battering eyelashes and nose-cone bosoms making him think he was the prize stallion at the stud farm. Maybe it had brought out the latent polygamist in him. Whatever the case, as the days went by, I realized I was not going to get any peace from these thoughts unless I got to the bottom of the matter. I needed to investigate. I didn't want to hire a private detective, the way they did in all those movies. The gumshoes were always men, and I couldn't trust them either. I also didn't want to follow Jim around myself, the way I did my first husband in Chicago. I'd known that crumbum was a louse. I just needed to prove it. With Jim, I was trying to make a determination of the facts, and the more quietly, the better. Besides, Phoenix was a lot smaller than Chicago, and people knew me. I was a schoolteacher with a reputation to maintain. I didn't want to get caught lurking in the alleys. So I enlisted Rosemary's help. "But Mom, I don't want to spy on Dad," she said when I explained the enterprise. "It's not spying, it's investigating," I said. "He might be cheating on me, but we don't know. He might be innocent. That's what we hope, and that's what we're trying to prove, that he's innocent." How could the girls say no to that? I figured that if something was going on between Jim and the floozy, the odds favored lunchtime assignations. The consequences of being caught in the warehouse with your pants around your ankles were a little too serious. Rosemary had spring break coming up. My plan was for her to spend her week off school following Jim during his lunch hour. If Jim and the floozy were going at it, they were probably doing so at least on a weekly basis. If during that week there was no suspicious activity, I decided I could let him off the hook. The first day of our investigation, it was hot for spring, and the cloudless sky was a deep, almost dark blue. I parked the Kaiser a couple of blocks from the warehouse. I told Rosemary to hide in the alley across the street and follow Jim when he came out at lunchtime, making sure to keep several other people between them in case he happened to turn around. I gave her a pencil and pad. "Take notes," I said. She had a look of resignation about her, but she took the pad and got out of the car. "It'll be fun," I said. "We're gumshoes." I sat there for half an hour, trying to read the paper, but mostly checking my watch and studying passers-by. Then Rosemary came up the street and got back in the Kaiser. "So what happened?" I asked. "Nothing." "Something must have happened." Rosemary sat there staring at her shoes. "Dad ate lunch, in the park, by himself." She'd followed him, she said, and he'd gone into a grocery store, come out with a paper bag, and walked to the park, where he'd sat on a bench and taken out a packet of saltines, a chunk of bologna, a chunk of cheese, and a carton of milk. He'd used his pocket knife to cut a slice of bologna and a slice of cheese for each cracker, and he drank the milk in little swallows, nursing it so it would last. Rosemary smiled as she said that, as if the sight of her father sitting in the sun eating his bologna and crackers and rationing his milk had made her feel good about the world. "That was it?" I asked. When he was done, he brushed the crumbs off his fingers and rolled himself a cigarette. "Good," I said. "We'll do it again tomorrow." On the second day, Rosemary got out of the car with a pencil and pad, and I sat there for a while drumming my fingers on the steering wheel. Then around the corner came Jim with Rosemary. He was holding her hand, and she looked a lot happier than when she'd left. Jim knelt down by my window. "Lily, what the hell is going on?" I thought of coming up with some complicated lie, but Jim was smarter than that, and I knew the game was up. "I was trying to prove to myself and Rosemary what I hoped would be the case, that you are a faithful husband." "I see," he said. "Let's all go have lunch." He took us back to the grocery store, where we bought bologna and crackers and cheese and milk and had us a right fine picnic in that same park. But that night, when he got home, Jim said to me, "What say the two of us have a little sit-down?" I fixed myself a whiskey and water, and we sat out in the yard behind the adobe house where little fruits were starting to come in on the orange trees. "I wasn't spying," I said. "I was just confirming that everything between us was copacetic. I don't want you cheating on me with that floozy." "Lily, I'm not cheating on you. But it's a part of city life that men are going to find themselves, from time to time, in the company of women who are not their wives. You got to trust me." "It's not that I don't trust you," I said, "but I'm not going to stand idly by while some floozy tries to steal my man." Maybe we're all feeling a little pinned up in this city. Maybe it's making us all a little crazy. "Then maybe we should leave," I said. "Maybe we should." So that's settled. Now we just got to find us a place to go. Chapter 9. The Fly Boy. Horse Mesa was a fly speck of a place. A glorified camp, really, built for the men who worked at Horse Mesa Dam, which held back the waters of the Salt River, formed Lake Apache, and generated electrical power for Phoenix. Only 13 families lived in Horse Mesa, but those families had kids, and the kids needed a teacher. And that summer, I got the job. We traded in the fancy but unreliable California Kaiser for a good old made-in-Detroit Ford, and one day in July, packed our suitcases in the trunk and headed east, first to Apache Junction, then up to Tortilla Flats, where the asphalt ended. From there, we followed the Apache Trail, a winding dirt road up the Superstition Mountains, which for my money were even sweeter on the eyes than the Grand Canyon. We drove by massive cliffs of red and gold sandstone, their layers of collapsed sediment pushed up at an angle like a bunch of books leaning against one another on a shelf. The mountains were studded with saguaros, staghorns, and prickly pears, which were ugly as hell, but you had to admire their ability to thrive in even the driest, stoniest, most inhospitable cliffside cranny. And darned if they didn't manage to produce some tasty fruit. After several miles on the Apache Trail, we came to an even narrower dirt road leading off to the north. We followed it over a ridge and down through a series of sharp, steep switchbacks, passing beneath overhangs and around otherworldly rock formations. Jim was at the wheel, and he made the Ford crawl along, hugging the mountainside as there was no guardrail, and the ground fell away so abruptly on the other side that with one miscalculation, we would plunge into the abyss. The road was called Agnes Weeps, after the town's first school teacher, who had burst into tears when she saw how plunging and twisting the road was, and realized how remote the town must be. But from the first moment I laid eyes on it, I loved that road. I thought of it as a winding staircase taking me out of the traffic jams, news bulletins, bureaucrats, air raid sirens, and locked doors of city life. Jim said we should rename the road Lily Sings. We followed Agnes Weeps all the way to the bottom of the canyon, then came around a bend, and saw a deep blue lake with red sandstone cliff walls rising on all sides around it. Across a short bridge, perched on one of the cliffs and looking down on that lake, was Horse Mesa. It was just a cluster of wooden houses, and it was remote. Agnes had been right about that. A truck brought in groceries twice a week from the commissary at Roosevelt Dam. There was only one telephone in the community center. If you wanted to make a phone call, you had to put in a request through the operator at the Tempe substation, who gave you an appointment and, at the designated time, routed the call through Mormon Flats, and everyone at the community center got to hear your conversation. But from the get-go, we were all darned happy to be at Horse Mesa. Since it was summer, the kids spent the entire day at the lake, diving off the cliffs into the cool water. The river